Yes, the first time I was in the lock ward at the mental hospital. You don't forget something like that. I was in high school, very interested in neurology, neurophysiology, and had worked at UCLA in junior high school in the hospital doing some brain mapping experiments at what became the Committee for Advanced Science Training. And in high school, they offered a program, a liaison program between the high school and UCLA, where we could get high school credit for courses that we took at UCLA undergraduate. And wanting to push the envelope, I signed up in the med school for at least partially fulfilling a parental expectation for a course in neuroanatomy. I got lost wandering around the UCLA hospital, the then brand new wing of the Neuropsychiatric Institute, and found myself in a locked ward. I don't know how I got there, which is pretty much what they all said. And as I was searching for the exit, I became very anxious because why would they let me out? It was a locked ward. Yeah, I'm sane. Prove it. I began to have anxiety, paranoia, panic attack, and hysteria all at the same time. I was absolutely convinced by the time I got to that door, I could legitimately have been kept inside there. And I had no idea how in the world I would begin to prove my sanity. When I got to the door, all I had to do was show my registration for the class that was being held that night, and I guess these were more careless days and they actually let me out. Years later, as I reflect back on that, I'm still troubled by a couple of things. One, my presumption that I was sane. From my vantage point today, I look back at my teen years, and I think that that probably was an unfair presumption on my part. But also, even now, if called upon to prove my sanity, or any of us, our sanity, what would the evidence be? And would it be compelling? Or do we really know too much about ourselves and everything that goes on in the dark, subconscious, preconscious, and unconscious? Well, the next time I was on a locked ward, it was by clear choice and direction. I was doing my clinical pastoral internship at Napa State Mental Hospital. For some reason, our Department of Ministry thinks that working in the mental hospital is good preparation for a congregational ministry. And in a sense, the training was. The first day, my clinical supervisor said that there's only one difference between you and the rest of the staff and the people who are our guests. And that is that they've lost the ability to fake sanity. Wow. And it's true. That has been one of the most useful things and, in a way, comforting things that has ever been told to me. He said that everybody has lots of wild and chaotic feelings and thoughts and fantasies, disturbing images, and what separates the people whom we adjudge to be sane from the people that we decide to send away, if not physically, at least from intimacy and our lives, is our ability to sit through a really long, boring meeting and not go screaming from the room. Not fire off the photon torpedoes in our cars when people cut us off, as somebody did this morning. This morning was one of those I'm really glad I'm not packing heat days because items, trust me, I have every mad impulse that the people whom we call insane have. But most of the time, I'm able to stifle myself. I'm able to pretend to a calm, a poise, a sense of patience that is a social construct. Yes, it's real and it's part of me, and I don't want the message of this sermon is that John is an actor and he really wants to kill all of us and shut down the congregation. Only rarely, and never with a pledged result that's this good. There have been other seasons, but that's another story. But I don't separate myself, and my supervisor was really very helpful in understanding that we as human beings all have a lot of chaos underneath, a lot of inchoate feelings. I'm not a Freudian, but I do believe in an unconscious. I do believe that we carry around a lot of baggage, a lot of memories, some of them real, some of them accurate, and some of them not accurate, and after 10, 20 years, it doesn't make much difference. The videotape won't help if it's what you remember, because we have built and constructed defenses to deal with that. I had a bad back long enough so that I developed compensatory systems to take the weight off of certain parts of my back. When I played golf years ago, I had a slice that was consistent enough that I ended up winding up almost 90 degrees away from my target, which inevitably, if there was glass at 90 degrees, would be the one time I would hit the ball straight. But we psychically also develop all kinds of compensatory mechanisms. And that's why they call it, when we start losing it, decompensating. And we compensate and try to act sane and not act on our every impulse, on our every fear. We try not to be emotionally immediate. Children are very honest. That's a very nice thing. Sort of. It's a very nice thing that we do our best to train them out of, because watching my grandson Jack last night being upset and deciding that he would sublimate his upsetness by pushing his baby brother Nathan like that. It was very obvious, it's very immediate, it's very honest. But if you want to get along in the world, you find the appropriate channels. And that's the hard part, isn't it? Because there are a lot of activities that are completely sane and appropriate in private that aren't in public. I mean, if you go out and roll up the windows of your car and scream, you're not mad. If you do it in the middle of a symphony, you will be asked to leave. It's not the activity itself, it is our sense of the appropriateness of who and where we are. True story, I am not making this up. When I was a young divinity student, a friend of mine was called to do a sermon at a large, important, formal Unitarian church. And she preached a sermon where she had the power of God on her. She was speaking with the authority of God Almighty, and she was God's channel, bringing the truth to those people. They took her away. Now, had that guy, and this is not a joke, had that same sermon been delivered in an evangelical church or coming from the Oval Office, she would not have been taken away. It was not the content, and I do not say that her content was mad. I say only that her sense of place and appropriateness was off. If all of a sudden in this congregation I start doing the sermon in French or in Arabic, I'm somewhat disconnected. And she was disconnected from herself and from her sense of place, and she got help and she recovered. And she's fine today. I actually saw her a couple of years ago, and she is doing just fine. But it was not the content. It was the appropriateness, and I think that's an important model to think about. How it is that we act sane. But there's another question. That is, should we always act sane? Or there's a stickler out there, sanely. There's a distinction. Once upon a time, in very bad old days, we looked at people who we thought were crazy in two different ways. Sometimes we saw it as a blessing. Maybe indeed they are connected to a higher source, and they can prophesy, and they can speak in tongues, and they are connected to something more primal and basic. Just as often, or more often, we looked at them in terror and fear and banished them when we didn't burn them. We're very uncomfortable with people who we think are different. Now, my theory on this is we are very uncomfortable with people whom we think are different because we really know that we're not so different from them. I think that's very important. When I look at homophobic behavior, I almost always find it from people who have some issues in terms of their own sense. There's a wonderful scene in Sark's Nausea, where somebody comes into a bar and they're acting in a bizarre manner and everyone's very uncomfortable. And then they realize, oh, he's an escaped mental patient. Fine, that explains it all. They put a label on him. They've separated him. He's a different species. They're now comfortable. And they don't have to deal with their own issues and their own discomfort and the chaos that operates underneath. Well, let's use a good Unitarian Universalist line. At the quiet desperation that is underneath most human beings. Now, all of you who are evaluating how quiet you are and how desperate you are right now and saying, no, 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 he's not talking about me, or he is talking about me, I'm talking about everybody. If we are not moved by what goes on in our lives and in our world, if we handle all of the world and all of the joys and the concerns, all of the pain, with perfect equanimity, there's something deeply wrong with us. This is not a world that we should be perfectly balanced in. We have moved a lot in issues of mental health from the bad old days when we simply burned people at the stakes. Pastoral counseling and training has progressed from the days that people were trained to just say, take two Psalms and call me in the morning. Psalms were the Prozac and Valium of their day. The non-religious, unless they were Native American, might have gone for opium or alcohol. If you were Native American, you at least had the peyote possibility, but we have gone to talk therapy, which is also nice, to try to bring to the surface those things that we've repressed, get a handle on them, face our demons, call them out instead of burying them, because they tend not to stay buried. They tend to find expression. They tend to find expression in compensation and in ways that we carry around these burdens. But there's a whole other category. And the whole other category, of course, are the people that really scare us. The people on the street who hear voices, who talk to themselves, who sometimes shout seemingly to no one around. Many of them now are wearing earplugs and are actually on the telephone. It becomes very difficult when you've made this diagnosis that someone is utterly mad and they're only talking to their broker. I have very mixed feelings about these wireless plug-ins. We have We've made lots of progress in terms of dealing with these things and understanding so much of who we are is genetic, is hardwired, is chemical, it's not demonic possession, it's not being weak will, it's not simply a failure to fuck it up there, fella, and get with the program. Get over it. That was actually one of Derek Kiwat's jokes, but we'll do it. Just get over it. That's not always terribly helpful. We do have drugs to take the edge off. And I have mixed feelings. They're important. They're important, and people sometimes say, well, they're a crutch. If you break your leg, you need a crutch. There's nothing wrong with crutches. After your leg's healed, you don't need the crutch anymore, but people who will not get help on principle, it's like breaking your leg and saying, I won't use a crutch or a cast. You know, go to a reading room, but don't expect to get better. We don't, as the Buddhists say, pain is not optional, but suffering is. We don't have to suffer. But we also don't have to narcotize ourselves out of reality, out of being upset. And it's a balance. And how do we find the balance? With difficulty. It's not easy. There was a therapeutic institute in, of all places, Berkeley in the 60s that had as its motto, change, don't adjust. And like any kind of maxim, you can take it too far, but the meaning behind it was very important. And that is, change the world, don't adjust to it. There's that great Rudyard Kipling line, and I say great only because it's well known, but because I think it's wrong. If you can keep your head while all about you people are losing theirs, then you'll be a man. No, you'll be a monster. If you can keep your head and keep your perfect balance and equanimity when people are starving to death, when there are people on the streets, when we have an infrastructure crumbling, when there are wars and hatred and xenophobia and homophobia, if you can handle that with perfect equanimity, you have got a problem. You don't need to adjust to the world. You need to help the world adjust to your values and your vision. It is a precarious balance that we all try to maintain. And we lose our balance from time to time. We look at the world and we know we're connected to it. We look at our lives and we remember pain. And yet we need to draw back from time to time to recreate ourselves and make ourselves whole. And we need to reconnect to the world because there is no responsible escaping of what we need to do with our lives to make our lives and our values make a difference in a world that needs our talent and our commitment. And it's the hardest thing in the world to do, and it is the most important. Because we do not want to come to the end of our journeys and have the if only. If only I tried a little harder to fix that thing that was broken. If only I tried a little harder to open up my arms with a larger embrace to humanity. If only I'd worked harder for or against a candidate, for or against a cause, for or against something that expresses something that is deep and important within me. I, as everyone else, do not always know where that balance point is and where the tipping point is. And sometimes I have to just stop and remind myself not to be cynical. I have to remind myself that even when I have this implant to the news of the world and I am writing and studying all of the terrible things that happen in this world, that there is also in this rich tapestry so much beauty, so many opportunities to love nature, to love life, to love each other. And between the pain and the joy, between the light and the dark, we find this balance of light and shadow that keeps us going. And remember that balance is not stasis. Balance is compensating one way and another. It's in movement. Sometimes we work hard not to decompensate, but we also don't want to overcompensate. We just move back and forth within a range of joy and despair to find a balance that gives us the strength to embrace and change and engage this beautiful, terrible, wonderful world.